I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. Before we get started, I want to mention the call-in line, which is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history. In 1862, the USS Monitor sinks in rough seas off the coast of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. The Monitor had been part of a revolutionary development in naval warfare 9 months earlier, having fought against the Confederate ship Virginia in the first contest between two ironclad ships. The changeover to ironclad vessels was critical in allowing ships to withstand heavy bombardment by opposing forces during the Civil War and later conflicts. In 1903, the deadliest theater fire in U.S. history occurs as flames engulf the Iroquois Theater in Chicago, killing more than 600 people during the performance of a popular play. The building had been criticized for not having a fire alarm or sprinkler system, both later becoming standard safety features at public buildings around the United States. And in 1950, in the early days of the Korean War, U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson calls for more aggressive American military efforts around the globe after hundreds of thousands of Chinese troops cross the border into Korea, threatening a third world war. When most people hear about spies, they think of James Bond and his daring exploits defeating villains around the globe. Yet spies have been around for thousands of years, some of them employed by governments to help defeat enemies and assist in toppling dangerous regimes. Spies were critical in helping General George Washington to gain valuable intelligence after British troop movements and battle plans during the American Revolution. As Philadelphia was the colonial capital, our city was a hotbed of spy activity throughout the 8-year-long struggle for independence. Spies and informants helped Washington prepare and adjust his strategies to defeat the British. These men and women literally changed the course of American history, providing valuable information that affected the outcome of several battles and the entire war. Today's guest is author-historian John Nagy, who's written several books on spies, including Invisible Ink, Spycraft of the American Revolution, Spies in the Continental Capital, Espionage Across Pennsylvania During the American Revolution, and Dr. Benjamin Church, Spy. John's books are so well regarded, the CIA has at least one of them as recommended reading for its personnel. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Just to get back to an old story, spies have been around for literally thousands of years. What was the first use of spycraft to actually win a war in general? Are you aware of it? One's going back hundreds of years?
Well, actually, the earliest recorded spy technology that was written down was by Sun Tzu, 6th century B.C. He was a Chinese general. I don't know exactly which war or the name of it, but that's how far back it goes.
Mm-hmm. He wrote the famous The Art of War.
The Art of War is his book, correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and, it was used in biblical times, and, it's just been around. Every time there's a war, a general wants to get the advantage over the enemy, so he's always going to try and use spies to get that advantage, to whatever they can.
Right. Right. You have written several books on spies and the colonial period in America. How important were spies during the French and Indian War? Some people call it the Seven Years' War.
Quite a bit. Washington, when he was out on the Pennsylvania frontier, actually at one point he sent out Indian spies to go in amongst the French troops, collect intelligence, and come back. He also sent a spy into Fort Duquesne to scout out the fort and find out the exact positions of where the French soldiers were bivouacked in the fort and also outside the fort.
Now, were these... Go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, I was about to say, were these spies employed around, would it be Pennsylvania or nearby states?
Well, Pittsburgh and a general area, a place called Logstown, which is about 18 miles northwest of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Did these spies play an important role in helping the British to defeat the French?
Washington wound up losing out there. It actually he got the information, but his problem was he didn't have enough soldiers to go up against the French. He had like 150 soldiers against 1,000 of the French. The odds were not very good.
Mm-hmm.
He also picked a very poor place to have the battle. The French were able to get to cover and fire on the Fort Necessity that he had built from cover in Washington. You know, when you're in the fort, eventually, if you can't move the enemy out of there, it's going to be a losing proposition. And the fort became a muddy quagmire, and he eventually had to surrender.
Mm-hmm. You know, today, most people think of spy techniques as almost all electronic, and we've just got a minute before we take a break, but real quickly, what types of spy techniques were used back in the mid to late 1700s?
Invisible ink, several different methods. One using that probably most people have tried over the years, which is using lemon juice. You write with lemon juice, it becomes invisible, you hold it over heat, and the lemon juice appears as brown ink. What you're actually doing is with the lemon juice and anything that's slightly acidic will work. You weaken the fibers of the paper, and when you hold the weakened fibers of the paper next to heat, the weakened fibers turn brown faster than the unweakened fibers. You just got to remember to move it from the heat before it goes up in flames or the whole thing goes brown.
Very good. That's interesting. I think a lot of people saw that in the National Treasure movies. We are going to take a very quick break for a commercial, but we will be back with John Nagy talking about spies.
Sending your son or daughter off to college is an exciting time. You've prepared them, but what is the school doing to ensure their safety? 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. As a parent, you want to know what kind of efforts the college is taking to prevent sexual assault. Is support available? What policies are in place? The Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape is focusing on making colleges safer. For more information and to learn how you can help, visit pcar.org.
Are you tired of looking up at that old, streaky, stained, tired, ugly roof? Tired of that ugly roof taking away from your home's curb appeal? G.P. Martini Roofing wants to solve your curb appeal woes with a new roof built with Atlas Pristine Shingles featuring Scotch Guard Protector from 3M, the only shingle with a lifetime limited warranty against algae, streaks, and stains. G.P. Martini's crews are highly trained professional installers of asphalt shingle roofs, and now with the power of Atlas Shingles and Scotch Guard Protector from 3M, GP Martini will install a roof that will provide the lasting color you choose for as long as you're in your home. Let GP Martini Roofing have a look at that nagging leak, or just call to consult about upgrading the look for your prized investment. Call them today, 610-873-1696. Whether your need is residential or commercial, GP Martini Roofing has the expertise in-house to solve your problem, or to simply make your home or office look its best. 610-873-1696. That's the number to call. 610-873-1696. And one of those GP Martini trucks will be on its way to you.
You're listening to 1520 AM WCHE Westchester. Heard worldwide at WCHE1520.com.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History, and we're talking with author, historian John Nagy about spies. John, did General Washington have a large network of spies, or did he just engage them as needed on a spot basis?
No, the way it worked in the 18th century is that every general was responsible for running his own intelligence operation. And in many cases, underneath the generals, the colonels also ran their own spy operations. So basically, every place you have a general, you have a spy network. every place you have a colonel, you have a good chance that they were also running spies. And then you have Washington at the top of the chart, coordinating the information from the different generals. Washington had a habit, which he continued throughout the entire war, of comparing one spy's report against another spy's report, or as many as he could get a hold of. If he could get more, he used more to make sure he wasn't being tricked.
Right. In your, I know you've done extensive research on this over the last several years. Did Washington very effectively coordinate the activities of all these spies? I mean, it must have been difficult to track all their actions and make sure they weren't kind of interfering with each other.
Well, he coordinated the actions of the generals and then really relied on the generals to coordinate the actions of the people below them. So he was a very good manager, supervisor over the whole operation. And where he excelled was in the military application of the intelligence. The British actually collected more information, but did not use it as effectively. And that's really the big difference between the two sides, is
sure.
Washington, his handling of the material.
Mm-hmm. Most people are aware of the name Benedict Arnold, but they don't know really a lot of the details behind the story. Tell us a little bit about how he tried to thwart Washington's army and turn the tide of the revolution and how it related to any spy activities.
Well, Benedict Arnold was put in command of Philadelphia as the military commander of it when the British left. And until they could figure out exactly what belonged to the state, the merchants were not allowed to sell anything. Now, they had a procedure whereby if the military didn't want it, they were allowed to sell it, but Benedict Arnold got involved with a couple of individuals, and they made a deal where these individuals were going to buy material from the army and turn around and sell it, but the materials that they didn't want were down in the Jersey Shore. And Arnold took military wagons and sent them down there to remove them, claiming that he was keeping them from falling into British hands. He was going to be court-martialed, actually he was court-martialed over the whole incident. He got fed up with that and also the fact that he had not been reimbursed for his expenditures from his invasion of Canada in 75. There was a discrepancy in the amounts of handling of money. So he went to and he contacted the British. He used a person in Philadelphia, Joseph Stansbury, a merchant, to be his go-between, and Stansbury would code and decode the messages at the Philadelphia end. They were transported across New Jersey, given to the Reverend Jonathan O'Dell, who previous to the war was the Anglican minister at Burlington and Mount Holly in New Jersey. And he became a secretary to General Clinton in New York. And he would do the coding and decoding at the other end. And Arnold had used several different codes, and he used the code name Monk for in place of his name on the documents.
Mm-hmm.
And the British had him get a position of being in charge of West Point. And he wrote to the British offering the letters in code, and it's been decoded, where he's offering West Point to the British for £20,000.
And it's been speculated or perhaps maybe documented over the last couple of centuries that he finally turned his coat on the American Continental Army and went to the British because he felt spurned by Washington and not having been promoted as aggressively as some other generals. Is that correct?
Well, he was unhappy about that, but there wasn't really Washington could do about it because Congress had decided that the states could only have two generals each, and Connecticut already had his two generals, and he was from Connecticut.
Okay.
So there was no question that, there was nothing Washington could do about it.
Sure. No, I understand.
He wasn't happy, that's for sure.
Yeah. Your books, and you've written several now on this topic, indicate that Philadelphia was a hotbed of spy activity due to the presence of the Continental Congress and both the American and British armies nearby. Which side used the most spies in and around this region?
Around Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Definitely. I've never sat down and figured it out, but because the British also had a spy ring operating in Philadelphia. The Americans had a spy ring operating in Philadelphia. I would say a little bit more on the American side.
Mm-hmm.
When the British were occupying it.
Okay.
But the British had long-term spies in Philadelphia.
Sure.
Because they only occupied it for, September of 77 to June of 78.
Right.
And the rest of the 8 years' war, it's in American hands. And so the British used the same spies that they had in place for, the entire length.
Right. I thank you for that. From your research, which spy network, the British or American, was the most sophisticated, in your view?
Sophisticated?
Yes.
It has to be the Culpers and the use of different technology. But the Culpers had to for the way they operated.
Now, they were serving the American Continental Army, correct?
They were serving the Continental Army. The first spy ring is up in Boston, and that's with Carnes, an American spy in Boston. Second is the Mercereaux, who operated from New Jersey onto Staten Island. Third is a British spy ring that operates in Philadelphia. The fourth spy ring that I found is the Clark ring, which operates out of Newtown Square into Philadelphia. Very effective. And they warned Washington of the British coming out in force, and in force was 10,000 men to attack at White Marsh.
Mm-hmm.
So Washington was totally prepared for them, and the British spent 3 days of frustration trying to turn Washington's flank, and because he knew the information of their coming out there, he had grabbed all the spots he wanted.
Yeah, my research. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, so the British were never able to get him into a full-scale battle that they wanted, and they gave up and went back to Philadelphia.
I had read, doing a bit of research, that a woman named Lydia Dara lived near Philadelphia and apparently overheard British officers talking about an attack on Washington's army near White Marsh. Maybe just tell us just a little bit more about that.
Okay. Lydia Dara lived on South 2nd Street at the corner of South 2nd and Little Dock Street. And she lived right across from John Cadwallader, American General Cadwallader's house, which the British at one point used for their headquarters. When they needed extra space, they would go across the street and commandeer your living room, which was also a part-time store. And so she would pretend have everybody else go to bed, and she would stay up and listen through. It said a closet, but in either case, she would listen in to get the messages. She would write the messages. Her husband would write the messages, William, and they would place the messages underneath the cloth covering on buttons. In the 18th century, it was fashionable to have a coat with buttons covered in the same fabric as the coat itself, and the reason why is the button. It's either going to be bone, wood, or scrap metal.
Mm-hmm.
And the 14-year-old son would go out through the lines, contact his older brother, who was a 22-year-old lieutenant. He would then decode the messages and pass the information on to Washington.
Interesting. So it did give him information before the actual battle around White Marsh.
Yes. Actually, both the Clark spy ring and Dara did, and the information that Dara's provided came after the Clark ring, so it confirmed the information the Clark spy ring provided, and as I said before, Washington always tried to get more than one source of his information.
Sure. If we could jump forward a century or two, When did spy techniques become much more sophisticated using electronics? Was it right before World War One or afterwards?
Using the electronics, well, the telegraph was used heavily during the American Civil War by both sides. And the South used a thing called the Vicksburg Square, which was an old cipher but a new name. The Americans, the Union, used a running cipher, which supposedly they claim was never broken, but nobody knows for sure.
Hmm.
And then you get telegraph being used at the beginning of World War One as well.
Actually, it had been around since 1840, so yeah, probably very extensively used. We've got to take a break here, but real quickly, in about 10 seconds or less, aren't many spies simply intelligence officers collecting data? I mean, they're not cloak and dagger people. They're just collecting information. Is that right?
Well, the spies are... You have intelligence people operating the spies as a case agent.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the spies actually are people who are being paid to go on a mission to gather intelligence and bring it back.
All right. I appreciate that. You know, we've actually reached the end of our show. John, thank you so much for joining us to discuss a fascinating topic. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday, the January 6th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be speaking with David Reinfeld, Acting Director of the Chester County Historical Society. Thank you for joining us for Living History.